All right. Thanks so much, Doctor. My name is Jake. My question is, if God is omniscient, omnipresent, and omnipotent, how can people say he didn't create sin?
He didn't what create?
Create sin.
All right, I'm happy to go, and then please feel free to... I don't mean go away, I mean go for their question. Yeah, yeah. Notice how happy they were. No, that's all right, you may leave. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're free to go. In fact, there's a song like that. You know, you're free to go, darling, or something like that. If God is omnipotent, omniscient, and omni whatever it was you added in there too, it's true. How can it be that he did not create sin? Let me give you a simple illustration, and then I'll be happy for Mary Jo and Andy to pitch in also. If I make a car that can be a near-perfect car, let's say it's a flawless car, it's running beautifully, I have the power to create an automobile that would provide for you transportation, and that transportation is what the automobile was made for. If somebody uses that automobile to run over another human being, can you blame the creator of that automobile for having created a weapon to destroy? There are ultimate causes, there are instrumental causes. See, the Christian message, where are you seated? So at least I can see you in my direction. There you are. Yes, sir. The Christian message is the only message in the world where love precedes life. In everything else, love succeeds life. Love precedes life in that the God of love, there is an integrating relationship of love within the Godhead. Love precedes your creation and mine. If love is truly to be the greatest gift given to humanity, it had to be given with the handmaiden of freedom. You cannot love without freedom. If love is the supreme ethic, freedom to not love had to be given at the same time. So being created upright, being created for love, and being given the great gift of freedom, if we take the freedom and use it against the God who has created us, we become the instrumental authors of sin and of rebellion. Sin came into the world not because God created sin, but God, in creating us for love and for purpose, also gave us the freedom to not love and to reject that love. So he is the ultimate creator, and one can push that back if they choose to, but he is not the instrumental creator of sin. Human beings instrumentally chose to do that evil. Take, you know, today when we got into the airplane in Atlanta, I'd never seen such a lineup. We had to walk 15 minutes just to reach the beginning of the line we were sort of going in. You know, this sort of like a spaghetti type thing, up and down, up and down, 15 minutes just to get to the last portion of the line. And I was standing there waiting to go through security, and I thought to myself, how did all this happen? We've got airplanes created here to give us a journey, to give us the enjoyment of travel, the speed of travel, but some lunatics and some vile people will use the presence of an instrument in the air to blow it up and kill people in their wake. Is Boeing responsible for that? No, it isn't. The human heart, when it rebels against God, is the instrumental cause of sin. Love is the supreme ethic. You cannot have love without freedom. And so, yes, God is omnipotent, omniscient, and also immutable, unchanging. In all of those strengths that God has, he created us for a purpose, and that purpose was for love and relationship. And the supreme purpose is found in worship. But if you violate that, you bring evil and injustice in the world. And so, you know, when Richard Dawkins talks about God in all of these nasty terms, but then again, he says he doesn't believe in God, so God didn't do those things then. It's us. But what did he end up with ultimately saying? That there's no such thing as evil either. But if there's no such thing as evil, then what's wrong with God being all of those things? Well, he ties himself in knots, but sounds very brilliant in the process of doing it. So I just leave that with
you. All right. Thank you, Dr. Zacharias. We'll direct the next question to Andy.
Hi, Andy. My name is Ali. I have a question. If, as Dr. Zacharias said, that the one peg that the Christian faith stands on that's the most strong is the resurrection and the death of Jesus Christ, how can there be such a great dissension between the Muslims who counter, you know, a billion plus and the Christians who also account to a billion plus of the people of the world? If truth is so absolute, why is there such a big difference on this one peg of theism?
Gee, that's a great question. I'm glad you asked it, because as Matt sort of kindly shared in his introduction, my academic area is Islam. I've been dialoguing and discussing with Muslim friends and academics for some 25 years now. My PhD is in Quranic studies, so I know the Quran fairly well. What's interesting, I think, is at the heart of your question lies something very, very important. I think one of the reasons why people sometimes tie themselves up in knots when it comes to questions about comparative religion is we like to assume that, you know, people like to sort of say, well, maybe all the religions in the world are true. Maybe, you know, all the religions are just different paths at the top of the mountain. Can't we just all affirm each other, hug each other, and sort of not have arguments about who's right? But on something like the resurrection, and in fact the crucifixion that preceded it, we're dealing with a historical fact here. And it's not, in fact, the resurrection that Muslims and Christians disagree on. It's the crucifixion. Because the Quran denies in the fourth chapter, verse 157, that Jesus was crucified. It flat out denies the crucifixion took place. And in fact, many Muslim theologians believe that that God made somebody else look like Jesus, and the substitute was crucified in Jesus' place, all the while Jesus was kind of shot up to heaven, behind the scenes. Christianity, on the other hand, affirms very, very clearly, very ardently in all four of the Gospels and other New Testament writings that Jesus of Nazareth was killed, was crucified by the Jews and the Romans on a cross on a Galilean hillside, Judean hillside, sometime in the early 30s AD. Now, you can't reconcile those claims. Jesus can't be both crucified and not crucified. You really have to be one or the other. Crucifixion was a sort of fairly final exercise. The Romans knew how to kill people. And in fact, secular historians will tell you that the crucifixion of Jesus by those authorities back then is probably one of the most certain facts of first century history. We are on incredibly solid historical bedrock. One reason being that the first disciples, the first followers of Jesus, had no reason to invent the crucifixion. They claim that Jesus was the Messiah. The Messiah was supposed to overthrow the Romans, not get killed by the Romans. It's deeply embarrassing. In fact, Paul in 1 Corinthians describes the cross as a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. And that certainty of the crucifixion is actually one of the planks of the historical argument for the resurrection, along with some other pieces we could perhaps talk about afterwards. But I think the resurrection is what stands at the heart of the Christian faith. And the resurrection and the crucifixion taken together force us to confront a historical question. Did these things actually happen? In which case, Christianity is true. And the question then becomes, what am I going to do about that? How am I going to respond? This is not some abstract intellectual game. Or are they not true? And in which case, I probably have to write Jesus off as a liar or a deceiver or as badly deluded. But if I look at his life and his ministry and his teaching, and I conclude that's not the case, and then I look at the historical evidence there in the Gospels, and remember the Gospels are written within, you know, 50 or 60 years of the life of Jesus, the Quran 600 years after Jesus, I think the historicity of the resurrection and the crucifixion is one hugely important reason why I stand before you as a Christian today, because it actually happened. And there's only one good reason to be a Christian: if it's true. If it's false, it's nonsense, and we should dismiss it. If it's true, then I think we need to bow the knee and proclaim him Lord and Christ.
That's great. We'll take one from over here, and we'll direct it toward Mary Jo. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to attempt to articulate this. My name's Anastasia, and my question is, how do you explain ancient belief systems such as the ancient Egyptians' various gods that are akin to the story of the heavenly battle and the gospel story regarding the supernatural and whatnot? I mean, there's more to it than that, but Why do you think they are so similar?
Oh, okay. What was your name? I'm sorry.
Anastasia.
Anastasia. Thank you. Anastasia. Comes from the resurrection, your name.
Right.
Yeah, Anastasis. So the thing with the similarities between like Egyptian mythology and the Christian story of Jesus, if I'm hearing you appropriately, along those lines. Right, Mithras, Osiris, Horus, those sorts of things. Yeah, what's interesting about these comparisons, what I have found is that when you peel back to the primary sources, let's say we go back to the hieroglyphics, we go to the Egyptian Book of the Dead, we actually read the pyramid text for ourselves, and we try to scope out Jesus' story in there, it's not in there. And this is problematic because what this argument, which is a very popular argument right now, especially, it was one of the most, it was one of the ways that people found my blog, was by searching for Jesus and Osiris or Jesus and Horus. And that was how people were getting to me the most, was through this argument. It's very popular. What is spawning this? What I found is that the scholarship that was done in these schools of religious thought, the comparative religions, what they were doing was they were framing a mythic hero archetype. So sitting around thinking up, what does the mythic hero look like? Well, this is who he would have to be. Coming up with 12 or more items. And then would go out into the world and try to find the mythic hero archetype they're presupposing in every religion. Whether it's the Incas, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, Quetzalcoatl, whoever it is, they're going out and trying to find that match. That's called a confirmation bias. You already presuppose what's there, and then you're going to be able to find it in anything you're looking at. But I have found that if you go back to the original sources, and you're reading the stories, the mythologies, from the primary sources, not necessarily, maybe a translation, right? Because we're not reading Egyptian hieroglyphics, or we're not reading the Greek necessarily. The first thing I found is that the stories are not the same when I go back to the primary sources. Okay, that's the first problematic thing. So like the Zeitgeist, the movie where they list, you know, all of these similarities with Jesus, those blow up they blow up in two ways. First, they blow up in that they're not in the primary sources. Second, they blow up in that they get the Christian story wrong. Things like Horus being born on the 25th and Jesus being born on the 25th of December for the winter solstice. Well, that's not when Jesus was born. So we've got problems with that. Another problem is the parallels are not really parallel. So we've got Horus and Osiris as being touted as having virgin births, you know, like Jesus. But when we look at what those virgin births were, a lot of times they are, it's a stretch of the word virgin birth, especially with Mithras. Let me use Mithras as an example because he's one of my favorite. Mithras jumps out of a rock near a riverbed, out of a cave by an ancient fig tree. And he's got a dagger in one hand and he's got a lantern in the other by which he's going to use these to subdue all of the earth in his fight, you know, against all of the earth. Jumping out of a rock next to a river by a sacred fig tree is not the same thing as what we traditionally view as a virgin birth, a woman who's never had sexual intercourse. You've got Horus and Osiris in their stories. You have adulterous affairs between gods, things like that. Osiris and Isis have... like Isis has intercourse with the dead Osiris's body. That's one story of Horus's birth. That's not a virgin birth. So you find problems with the parallels when you actually start to look at them one-to-one and you go through things like virgin birth, resurrection. Osiris is resurrected, how? What is he resurrected to? What does it mean? He's resurrected to the land of the dead. He goes to live in the land of the dead where he rules over them. It's some kind of spiritual realm. It has no similarity to the Christian resurrection of the physical body, right? The new heavens, new earth resurrection. So there's not a similarity there unless you strain it, unless you go in with like a confirmation bias and you're trying to make it fit your paradigm. And then finally, the last thing that really just blows me away is that these mythologies have extremely different philosophical and theological worldviews, basically. Just very different. The Egyptians were known for an eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die, because in the afterlife, They don't know what's going to happen to them. Their heart is weighed against a feather, and if their good works don't come out on top, they are either annihilated or spend eternity in hell. This is very different teaching from the Christian resurrection, the Christian views of salvation in Jesus Christ and the resurrection, the restoration of the good creation. In fact, in many of the pagan mythologies, they want released from the body. They don't want to come back to the physical body. They want to go be in the spiritual realm with their gods. That's a different philosophy and a different theology. And it's interesting to know in the Christian scriptures in Acts 17, when Paul goes to the Areopagus on Mars Hill to talk to the men of Mars Hill about the resurrection, he gives a discourse on why he believes in the resurrection. The response from these pagan philosophers who know the mythologies, who know Greek philosophy as well, is, what is this new thing that you are bringing to us? Some of them thought he was what does this babbler wish to say? They are not saying, oh yeah, Paul, we know that story. It's Osiris. It's been around for thousands of years. They are saying, what is this new thing that you have brought to us? So it's confounding them. It's not something familiar. It's not something similar. And yet today we have this as a modern argument that has come forth that actually has been treated around the 1980s with Ronald Nash's work on this. When I started to encounter the argument, the scholars told me it was dead. There isn't a comparison. The worldview of Christianity doesn't compare to these. It's a dead argument. But yet, it's so popular now to say this. I would suggest getting the primary sources, then going to taking those parallels head to head throughout the mythologies, whoever it is, and then finally ending up with what is the theological and philosophical implications of that worldview that is espoused by those different stories, because they're going to be very different. Even if there are some similarities like rituals and the belief in an afterlife or spiritual life, there are some vast differences that are too important to ignore in the comparison.
That's great. Thank you. This question comes in from Twitter, and we'll thank you. Thank you.
I want to add a footnote to that, because I grew up in a culture of mythological accretion and so on, and what Mary Jo has said is just brilliant for you to plumb deeper into the differences. You know, when you come to the laws of logic, there are basically only three major laws of logic. There are other formal and informal fallacies. But one of the laws of logic being interpreted goes something like this. Just because two things have one thing in common doesn't mean they have everything in common. It's very important to know that. When you look at the gospel narrative, it doesn't come out with just sort of a resurrection idea or a resurrection motif. That's why Moses, Esther, you go through Elijah, you come on to the time of Stephen in his martyrdom, and then Jesus in the latter part in Luke when he goes through all of history. They're always wanting to connect the links. This is not just a simple sprig of an idea that suddenly emerges that Jesus rose again from the dead. It is a narrative where there are thousands of links, actually, and the Bible is not a single authored book in human terms. You know, you've got 40 authors, 66 books from Genesis to Revelation, the unfolding drama of redemption. To get the resurrection motif fitting into that narrative was very difficult to somehow manufacture. You can just come up with a resurrection story, but to come all the way from the creation of the world through the redemption and through the crucifixion, to the resurrection, all of which is prophesied, whether you look to the book of Job or go beyond that and see the illustration from Jonah and so on. The resurrection may be a peg, but it is not a peg that's hanging by itself. It is connected to such detail in history. And so we must know that you take one idea from here and find a parallel, be it the flood or be it the resurrection, and say, yeah, this is all copycat stuff. It really isn't. The drama of redemption is meticulously unfolded by 40 different authors living 1,500 years apart. There's a drama and there's a reality to it, that took an awful lot of manufacturing if the whole thing were truly a fable. It was fitting together from the beginning of time all the way till the resurrection and then ultimately when he returns. I grew up with so many of these mythological stories. And you'd have to write to say, where did this story come from? You know, and they were sort of standalone type things. But in the gospel message, it is not a one event story. It is a story that comes right from the beginning through to the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's much more complex and densely textured than it is just a single idea or a truth where you may find some replication of an idea.
Beautiful. Question through from Twitter, someone in the room here, to you, Andy, if it's okay. So Dr. Zacharias spoke about the importance of love in the Christian life. How do we reconcile the love of Christ with the acts we see from God in the Old Testament, genocidal acts, that kind of thing?
Wow. I'm impressed that question. I'm glad that question came through Twitter, and I'm not expected to give an answer on Twitter, because answering that one in 140 characters would be a little tough, allowing two for the smiley face at the end. Do you know, it's interesting the way this question sometimes comes. I mean, the question is sometimes framed, you know, how do you reconcile the, you know, vastly different character of God in the Old Testament and the New Testament? And when I get that question from skeptical friends face to face, I sometimes like to play with them slightly and say, do you mean the fact that you have the loving God of the Old Testament and the God of judgment in the New Testament? And they go, well, no, the other way around. And I go, well, no, do you not see the problem? You can find passages in the Old Testament that talk about God's love in incredible ways. There are books like Hosea, one of my favorite Old Testament books. It's an incredible love story of how deeply God is in love with his people and with his creation and how much he's moved by our separation from him. And in the Old New Testament, Jesus talks about hell quite directly. Jesus comes right out and says, if your left eye is going to lead you into hell, pluck it out. It's better to enter, you know, the eternal life with one eye than go to hell where the fires are on forever. And so we need to be careful how we look at Scripture in this way. But then what do we do about these two competing images of God? I want to approach the question that way rather than look at specifics. I think one of the reasons we sometimes run into trouble is we have separated two things about in the character of God that we need to keep together. We have ripped apart God's justice from God's love and forgiveness. We love the idea of a God who's loving and merciful and forgiving and pats us on the head and goes, there, it's all okay. Do whatever you want, ideally. It's what we'd really like. And we've separated that from a God who is a source of holiness and righteousness, a God who is a judge. We don't like to talk about hell and judgment. We kind of think that was very Victorian. We like to push those things under the carpet. And we've separated those two things. But the problem is, in so doing, we've missed the richness of Scripture. You see, the God of the Bible is a God who is holy. He is a God who is utterly pure, utterly good, utter justice itself, utter goodness itself, before whom we can only tremble because of the lives that we've lived and the way we turned our back on him and what we've done to him and to each other and that problem of sin we touched on earlier. God is a holy, righteous God of judgment. And I want him to be, because if he isn't, we're in trouble. Who is going to uphold goodness and law and rights and dignity if that's not the kind of God we're talking about? But on the other hand, God is a God of forgiveness. The Bible is very clear on this. But I wonder if you've ever recognized something. Forgiveness and mercy and justice contradict. Have you ever noticed? Justice and mercy directly contradict one another. If you walk out of here this evening and on your way home through the streets of Vancouver, you commit some heinous crime. I don't know what, you buy Tim Hortons rather than Starbucks or something. No, worse. Far, far worse than that. And the police arrest you. You're taken before a hastily convened court tomorrow morning. And there's a jury of your peers. You're found guilty of this terrible crime. And the judge then looks down at you from her bench and she says, you have committed this crime and according to the law of Canada, I am duty bound to send you to prison for 20 years. And so therefore, to prison you go. The judge has been just, right? Has she been merciful? No, no mercy, no forgiveness. Okay, rerun the narrative. You walk out of here, you commit a crime on the way home, you're captured by the police, you're brought before a court tomorrow morning, found guilty by a jury of your peers. The judge looks down at you from her bench. She says, according to the law of Canada, I have to sentence you to prison for 20 years, but I am a judge who today is feeling merciful and forgiving. Get out of my courtroom before I change my mind. And you run as fast as your little legs will carry you. Now, Has the judge been forgiving? Yes, right? She's let you off. Has she been just? No, right? She's ignored the law. She's literally flung the law book away. And here's the problem. Forgiveness and justice always contradict. If you exercise justice, you have to ignore forgiveness. And if you exercise forgiveness, you have to overlook justice. And so if God is a God who is both just and righteous and holy and also merciful and forgiving, we now have a problem. Because those characteristics contradict. What do we do? Do we just throw out the characteristics of God we don't like and keep the ones we do? Well, the New Testament has the answer to what would otherwise be a contradiction in the heart of God. Because at the cross of Jesus Christ, what we are told is that God in the Bible, the God of the Bible who loves us so much, exercises his mercy not at the expense of justice, but through justice. Through the justice of the cross, where justice was upheld, where Jesus took the blame and the punishment that should have fallen on us, so we didn't have to. The cross solves that contradiction in the heart of God. And what we see in some of those passages in the Old Testament, we come face to face with what justice and judgment really look like and how terrible sin really is. But we need to be realistic and remember that is what each one of us deserve. For the way we have treated God, for the way we have treated each other. And were it not for the cross of Christ, where justice and forgiveness meet, that is what each one of us would face. And uncomfortable as some of those passages are, they remind me of the awesome holiness and righteousness and utter justice of God. And they send me running once again to the cross, where Jesus took the punishment that should have been mine. He lived the life that I should have lived and died the death that I should have died so that I might know forgiveness and peace and reconciliation with God. Hope some of that helps.
Thank you. And this question for you, Mary Jo.
Hello, my name's Lee. I asked this question on Twitter, so you can take this off your list if it happened to have been chosen, but now I'm sure that I get to ask. I'm sure a lot of us have experienced this. We've been thrown under the bus by friends and family who call us crazy to believe, for those that do believe. And so my question, with a disclaimer, I will never give up and I won't shy down. I am passionate about my love for Jesus. But in that passion, I still struggle. And my question is, how do we love neighbors who actively hate us and reject us solely because we're Christians? How can we let the gospel shine through us in those times?
That's a very good question. There's a beautiful teaching from Jesus on this. And it's one that I know that if I'm honest, I struggle with it, which is the passage from the Sermon on the Mount, Luke 6, in which Jesus is addressing the current teaching of the day, which is to love your neighbor and hate your enemy. And he teaches, instead, I say to you, love your enemy and do good to those who hate you or abuse you or persecute you. And that teaching is so important. I know this is not the practical version, but sometimes the practical comes as an outworking of the spiritual reality in our lives. And that teaching is so important because what Jesus is doing in that moment of saying, love your enemy and do good to those who hate you, is he is creating an environment in which hatred starves. He's creating the only environment in which hatred starves, which is unconditional love. Right? This is the passage, and I have it with me. Martin Luther King Jr. used this when he spoke on tolerance and how we were really going to love one another, the civil rights leader in America, when he said, returning hate for hate multiplies hate, adding deeper darkness to a night already devoid of stars. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. So when Jesus says, love your enemies, he is setting forth a profound and ultimately inescapable admonition, an inescapable admonition, right, to us, that we have to become the kind of people that see our neighbors who are even hostile sometimes in their approach to us, or our friends or coworkers or whoever, family members, that we truly see them as made in the image of God, as somebody worthy of respect, even when they don't know in the moment how they're acting, how they're coming across as disrespectful. It is our admonition, our inescapable admonition, to remember what Jesus said in that we have to love them very greatly. Now, how does that work out? It's very difficult. And I've because I have such an internet presence, I get a lot of hostile type. What was that? We get a lot of trolls. But I also get seekers. I get people who are truly seekers. And I've seen, here's the practical side. Here's the practical outworking of what Jesus was saying. I have to take care of me and how I'm going to respond to a person who is coming across hateful to me, because I do not know their situation. I don't know why they are angry. I don't know why they're upset and decided to come after me and throw arguments my way that are full of ad hominem. I don't know. There could be possible situations of abuse, hurtful or hateful experience in the church. They might have experienced great evil in their life and be suffering greatly. So my practical admonition is that I must take care of my side of the equation and love them, even when they're abusive in that way, you know, throwing ad hominem at me. And I'll show one example is I had a person back in the day when I say Facebook was good, back in 2006, when you could have a conversation with someone and Facebook wasn't using algorithms to take everybody out that you don't agree with, right? So you don't see that anymore. We used to have a Facebook group in which we were arguing 827 different topics on the existence of God with about 3,000 different people. And I would see people come in there, and in particular, I'm remembering one guy who came in there, and he was what we would call like an angry atheist. He's just an angry human who holds an atheist worldview, let's say that. And his argument was the pagan myth argument that we talked about earlier, you know, that they're all teaching the same thing. And as I worked with him on this, through the ad hominem, sometimes I would show him, this, my friend, this is ad hominem. Like, this, you can point out where this is just an attack on the person. But if you have an argument, if you have something that you would like to ask me as an argument, I'll still be willing to talk to you on that. And I will push them on that very thing. And what I saw with this gentleman is he moved from angry to friendly agnostic. To friendly agnostic. And so he was searching. And then he moved to a believer in God, but skeptical of Christianity. Right? Skeptical. And one of the things that he said that has always stayed with me, and it goes back to Jesus's admonition. He said, when I was on this path and I was atheist, I remember my atheist friends, as I was having these questions, they would shun me. They were angry with me. I got angry responses from them. And he said, as soon as I moved to agnosticism, there was a blog he was writing for. They just dropped him immediately. I guess he wasn't, you know, skeptical enough. He said this, but the Christians were the ones I knew would stay with me no matter where my journey ended up. And that made a huge impact on me over the course of my, you know, my questioning. And so today, that man's he's a joyful believer in Christ. But yeah, but what I would say is those are the practical steps. Take care of you. Allow Jesus' teaching not to be just a nice teaching, but a spiritual reality that you live by. Because Jesus also said that whatever we put into our heart, that's what comes out. It's the overflow of the heart. And so we will speak in that redemptive manner if we've put much of that redemption into us. Thank you for your question.
So we'll take one last question for tonight. For those of you still standing there, and for the questions being repeated over and over again on Twitter, we still have tomorrow night. We're going to do another Q&A session, so please come back for that. We'd love to take many, many more questions. But one last one for tonight for Ravi, if you don't mind.
Hi, I'm Andrew. I'd like to get maybe all three of you to give a brief response. What advice...
That was sneaky. Did you see that? Very sneaky.
What advice would you have for Christian students who are going to go into academia?
Christian students who are going to go to academia.
Going to academia.
What is your response to be to them? Is that what you're talking about, how to respond?
What advice would you give Christian students heading toward academia?
Well, you know, for a long time in evangelicalism particularly, we have been sort of had this anti-intellectual attitude that if you go into a deep study of any sort and get the intellect involved, that you're going to stumble and you're going to walk away from God. I remember when I went for graduate studies in philosophy, actually the president of my denomination phoned me, and I will never forget his words. He said, I'm not sure you should go there, and this is what he said, you will lose your keen edge. I'm afraid you will lose your keen edge. But then there's a counter perspective. You know, there's a limerick that went something like, there was a young student at Trinity who had cracked the square root of infinity, but to work with the digits gave him such fidgets that he chucked math and took up divinity. You know, we sometimes think if you're really sharp, you know, go into the sciences or math or something or law. If you really can't do very well at any one of those things, just think of theology or some such thing as a part-time. And yet when you look back upon some of the greatest institutions from Harvard to Yale and others, they were really built by Dartmouth. They were built by thinking, sober-minded, intellectual Christians. Harvard's original motto was not Veritas, which it is now. It was Veritas Christo e Ecclesia, truth for Christ and the church. And all of a sudden, they got rid of Christ and the church, and now it's Veritas dangling around there, you know, truth with nothing to really stand on. So I think, first of all, if I'm hearing you correctly, be a pursuer of good thinking, solid thinking, clear thinking. We need Christians in the academic world. We need Christians in law. We need Christians in medicine. I just wrote on Labor Day, for the Christian, there's no choice between sacred and secular. There's no such thing as secular for the Christian. There's either sacred or profane. Those are the two options. If you're an engineer, it is your sacred calling. If you are a doctor as a Christian, it's your sacred calling. You're not any less sacred than a person standing behind the pulpit and preaching on Sunday. You are honoring God in the call where He has put you. And we need to understand that the longest journey in life is between the head and the heart. Donald Kogan said it's the longest journey in life to connect the head to the heart, but we must have something in the head. You know? And that's therefore very critical that you learn. I'll let the others also speak because I think they will be adding. But, you know, when I walked out of theological education, I said, boy, I'm glad that last paper is over. I'm glad the exams are over. Little did I know the toughest part was yet to come in my calling. I'm not a masochist, but I'm called to go in front of hostile audiences. But if you do your homework, study hard, and undergird your answers with love, you will find huge numbers responding first out of respect for you and then out of respect of what you're saying. First they believe you as a person, then they believe that you have done your homework. And as I travel around the globe and I see young people for you, you know, 3 nights ago in Chicago, a 6-year-old boy came up to me and he said, today's my birthday. And you know what I want for my birthday? I said, what? He said, wisdom. And his father was standing next to him. I don't even know if I knew the word at age 6. So I said, you want wisdom? He said, yes. I said, what does that mean? He said, I don't know. He said, but I heard you say tonight that we needed wisdom, so I want wisdom in my life. And, you know, that little boy is going to go a long way in life if you've really got that hunger and want to learn and want to understand. So dedicate your life to be a good student and encourage others to. There's no premium on ignorance. It gets you into a lot of trouble, actually. So work hard. God buries His workmen, but His work has to go on, says Charles Wesley. And we need to reach every avenue of society where the thinkers do the thinking and it filters down into younger lives. So I encourage you to go the long road and the hard road to make an impact upon the next generation.
So I have a daughter who is in college, and she gave some advice one time that I'll pass along. And she said that don't wait to find out who you are in college, because in college you're typically away from the family that loves you and cares for you and has raised you. And so you go off to college and you're trying, the society tells us we're supposed to find ourselves there. And she says that is not an environment conducive to finding yourself. Too busy, too many tests, too much going on. In fact, that's how you get lost at college, is because you don't know who you are, you don't know what you're there for, you don't know where you're going, you have no trajectory, and so you get lost there at college. So she says, have conversations about the important things with your family, with your church, with your youth pastor, whoever it is, before you go off to college. Which is why I'm so glad there were so many students here tonight to ask us the hard questions. These kind of questions that Dr. Zacharias is bringing up and Dr. Bannister have been answering, these are questions for the home before they leave for college so that they can get good answers and think through hard philosophical issues so that the first time they encounter them is not outside the church. Right? These are questions for inside the church. What is truth? Does it matter? Can it be known? How do you know it? Those are questions that your 14 through 19-year-olds can understand. So that's one. I'm going to do a few others real quickly, is have these conversations in the home. Also, remember that, and I said this to the youth, Jesus is the greatest thinker who ever lived. When we go off to college, we look at all these great thinkers, and we don't consider the creator of thought, the author of life, the giver of imagination, right? We tend to make Jesus the imagination or the imaginings of humans rather than making human imagination a gift from God. So we forget that Jesus was the greatest thinker who ever lived, that a being who we could, as rational human beings, worship would have to be the perfectly rational being. That's the one that's worthy of our worship. So I would say to remember that. And then finally, give yourself some room for doubt. If you're going to go off to college, you do get bombarded with a lot. And doubt in itself, as expressed in Luke 7, doubt is not the story of John the Baptist there asking Jesus if he's the Messiah. Doubt, we see in that story, is not the sin, right? Doubt's not a problem. You can have doubts. It's the heart of the human. If you're a Thomas and you say, unless you give me what I want, I will never believe. Not enough evidence, God. That's a wrong approach. That's a hardened heart, right? But the person who says, hey, I don't know if you're the Messiah, and I have some questions. Are you? Because that person is suffering and in pain and having troubles, or they've encountered hard questions for the first time. That's not a hardness of heart. That's a person who's truly got an open mind, who's a true seeker, right? That's a free thinker. And so that's what I would say, is give yourself room for doubt as well. Thank you.
I always say that scholarship and academia are standing on the shoulders of giants, and with the two great answers behind me, I feel a bit sort of inadequate, really, to be the last piece of bread in a steak sandwich. But I guess one thing I would certainly say is enjoy scholarship. Don't do too much study, or you may end up with the arms of a scholar, and as Ravi pointed out, as a problem. I think I would just really kind of draw together the threads of what my two colleagues and friends here have said. I think sometimes Christians rail against the academy. I hear people say, you know, the university is liberal, the universities are lost, they're terrible places, and so on and so forth, which breaks my heart. Firstly, because it's not true. And if that's the case, it's because Christians have too often abandoned the halls of academia, retreated into the churches, and not really, you know, had a heart for the world of academia. And I'm always drawn back to that passage where, you know, Jesus said, you know, love the Lord your God with your heart, your mind, and your soul. I think sometimes in the contemporary church, we've done heart really well, we've done soul really well. We don't know what to do with the mind. And as someone who's been in academia for about sort of 11 or 12 years of my life, I mean, I loved study. I loved doing my PhD. They were fantastic times, not just because of the people I met, but because uncovering truth is wonderful. And I think we need to get back again a big vision of what it means to be a Christian in God's world. And to, if God has called you to academia, to go for it with every fiber of your being. If God's called you to the mission field, go for it with every fiber of your being. If God has called you to the marketplace to be in business or to be a homemaker or to whatever it is God's called you to do, go for it with every fiber of your being, because every square inch of this good world is God's and we can pursue what God has called you to. So if God has called you to academia, go for it. Throw your energy into it. Do it walking humbly and carefully with Christ, as Mary Jo reminded us. But above all, remember that people are watching. And I think this is true of the marketplace as well. The only way to be a real ambassador for Christ is people need to be close enough to us to taste the difference. What does it look like to be a Christian in academia? And as you study and as you go deeper, pray through that question. Lord, what does it mean to be a Christian academic? How do I show integrity? How do I handle truth and handle it well? How do I, you know, love my colleagues and my students and do that beautifully and well so that people looking at you go, not merely is this person a brilliant philosopher or a brilliant educator, whatever your discipline is, but there's something different about you. What is it? And when that question is asked, connect them back to the Christ who animates it all. We need more Christians in academia. We need more Christians in the arts and in business and in politics and all of those fields. Rather than retreat into the doors of our church, let's get out there. And there's a world waiting to hear the good news of Jesus Christ in the academy, the marketplace, in the home, and in our neighborhoods. Go get them.